Our second case this morning is United States against Lee. Counsel for the defense.
Thank you, Chief Judge Efron. May it please the court. Dean Fidel for Captain Lee. With me at the counsel table is my partner, Matthew Freitas. I've requested to reserve 5 minutes.
You may have it.
There are 4 points that I think this case concerns. The first is, was there a conflict of interest? The second is whether Captain Lee was fully and timely informed so he could make an intelligent election. The third is, must there be a showing of prejudice? And the fourth is, what relief is Captain Lee entitled to? So with that, that's where I'm headed, and suppose I begin.
Please proceed.
With respect to whether there was a conflict of interest, I don't believe there can be any serious question in this year 2008 that it presents a conflict of interest for a defense counsel to be raided by his adversary. I think that is a self-evident proposition. The one bit of embroidery I would offer on that point is that at page 5 of its brief, the government says that all there was here was, quote, a potential conflict of interest that never materialized. I don't understand that proposition. The reality was that Captain R, the defense counsel, was being raided by his adversary. That is an actual conflict of interest. And I, if the government develops that point in oral argument, I will plan to respond to it. But it's a proposition that I think is utterly unsupported. Turning, therefore, to the second question, I believe there are really grave problems with respect to whether Captain Lee was in a position to make an intelligent, informed election of counsel. First of all, the information, and obviously I'm referring to page 21 of the Joint Appendix, which is Captain Lee's declaration. Clearly what happened here was a tardy disclosure and an incomplete disclosure. The tardiness is apparent on the record. The transition appears to have been made at the Christmas, New Year's Eve, New Year's Day breakpoint, and for fitness reporting purposes.
Counsel, was the tardiness with respect to telling him that he was engaging in joint representation at the Article 32, or was the tardiness precisely?
The tardiness lay in the fact that it wasn't until February, on the eve of some open court proceedings, that Captain R disclosed the fact that he would be doing some prosecution.
So he did disclose that he would be doing it before he actually engaged in the activity, or no?
No, ma'am. What we must infer, because the fitness reports speak in terms of reporting periods, everybody here has had fitness reports, or OERs or OPRs, they relate to reporting periods. And the reporting period at issue is a reporting period that began January 1st of that year, some weeks, 4 to 8 weeks earlier. And as our papers explained, it's customary for officers to get some little heads up, at least, that one is being transitioned from one position to another, albeit within the same overall unit. The common sense suggests that it was sometime before Christmas Eve, New Year's Eve, that Captain R became aware that he was transitioning. Not until after he had made the transition, as far as the record indicates, did he bother to inform Cat Morley. Okay. So there's a considerable tardiness, I should say.
What are we to make of the fact that when he did inform him, at least as I understand the record, when he did inform him that he but that he obtained the consent, that yes, he could do that, and he still wanted him to represent him?
We make nothing of it whatever, and here's why. First of all, with respect to, there were three aspects of that. The tardiness is sort of a threshold issue. It's a concern because, as we pointed out, there is a duty of promptness in bringing to the attention of the client a certain fact or circumstance that bears on the relationship. But beyond that, the information furnished was concerned facts, and that information was severely deficient, as I'll explain in a second. It concerned the law, and that information was incorrect. And finally, it concerned options, and let's assume that that's slightly different from the law, although you could subsume it under the legal. And let me explain how each of those functions. Captain Lee was not told that the change had occurred earlier. There was some economy in the transmission of information here. He was not told that Captain R would be or already was working with or for the trial counsel. In other words, the personal relationship that either had already occurred, as the record suggests, or that would occur, as Captain R conveyed the information to my client, a key element was missing. He was not told that Captain R was going to be raided, was already going to be raided, or would be raided by trial counsel. Captain R materially understated the nature of the work that Captain R would be doing on the prosecution side of the legal, the LSSS. So that's as far as the communication of the applicable facts is concerned. With respect to the law.
Well, before we leave the facts, Judge Ryan, did that answer your question?
Mm-hmm.
How do we know from this record, first of all, the date on which the defense counsel was notified that he would be working in a prosecution function? There are inferences that can be drawn, but do we know as a fact the date on which he learned that he would be working a prosecution function?
No, but common sense suggests.
I understand that. That's fine. I understand the inferences that you've drawn. Secondly, do we know the date on which the defense counsel learned that he would be raided by the person who was acting as trial counsel in this case?
No,
we don't know that either. And do we know the date on which the defense counsel?
If I can just expand slightly on that. Ordinarily, an officer.
I'm not asking about inferences that can be drawn either from the record or from the experience that one might have from looking at the way that rating schemes work, because I think if we're talking about common knowledge and experience, we also know that it's not unusual for things to be done after the fact in the armed forces.
Yes, although the one footnote that I wanted to offer is ordinarily an officer would know what his or her rating chain would be. That's the only
I understand, but we don't know here the date on which he was assigned, the date on which he found the trial counsel was going to be his raider. Do we know the date on which he began to work with the trial counsel on a specific case?
No.
So we don't know any of those things. So in that situation, at best, why do we have anything more in this case than a situation in which further fact-finding might be required?
I believe that none of those facts is necessary in order to rule in Captain Lee's favor. Now, somewhat anticipating a point that I had intended to address under the question of relief. Obviously, if the court is not disposed to travel with us the full distance, then one could come up with that list of questions as well as other questions. That it would be, if the court felt that it currently lacked the kind of evidentiary foundation necessary in order to intelligently perform its functions, well, then the result would be a debate.
And last question in that regard, I'd like to ask this question first.
Okay.
Do we know what, if any, work the defense counsel did with respect to any performance under the supervision of the trial counsel in this case? What specific work did he do?
What defense counsel did?
Right. What the defense counsel did subject to the work supervision of the trial counsel.
When the
defense counsel in this case,
yes,
when he was subject to the supervision of the trial counsel, what specific work did he do under the trial counsel's supervision?
Our source of information, Your Honor, is the book that Second Lieutenant Pontano co-wrote about his own experience. That was an Article 32 investigation, which was conducted immediately before the last, I think, 2 days of, obviously pivotal 2 days of the trial in this case. We do know that. And presumably, since he, according to the extracts that appear in Lieutenant Pontano's book, he had a very active role during that Article 32 investigation, since attorneys do not responsibly, at least, do important matters such as an Article 32 investigation cold, it must be assumed that some degree of pre-Article 32 preparation was involved.
Is the record of that Article 32 investigation in the record of these proceedings?
No, it is not.
Thank you.
This is a related question, and I think I know the answer to it, just for the sake of completeness. Captain R., did he do any work in a prosecution function with respect to the case against your client? Then his client also. Do you understand my question?
Better ask it again.
Okay. Is there any allegation whatsoever that Captain R. acted in a prosecution function as well as a defense function in this case?
No, absolutely not. But that, there's not a whiff of that.
Is there any indication that in any actual way his work as defense counsel was adversely affected by his status?
You're
talking about a matter of status and a matter of actual conflict deriving from status. I'm talking about the actuality of his reputation.
That's the prejudice question. I will answer it immediately, but the one thing I have to say before I do is to wrap up the deficiencies in the information that was furnished. There was advice given, according to Captain Lee's declaration, that from Captain R. that there was no conflict of interest. That's an incorrect piece of legal advice. And second, the information furnished as to options, which is a key element of an election of counsel issue, was deficient because it was sort of presumed that the only option was firing Captain R. So with that, by way of...
What I'm asking is, did he represent Captain Lee zealously within the law?
I can tell you that he was an active participant. The record is replete with his legal work, and we have not made a claim because we do not need to make a claim that there was any deficiency.
Sure, that's what I'm trying to get clear.
Exactly right. Okay. And I think our position on that is set forth in our papers. Our view is, and it's reinforced by the judgment of the Supreme Court in Gonzales-Lopez, that on issues relating to choice of counsel, the search for error is not undertaken. The search for prejudice is not undertaken. I will quote three observations that Justice Scalia made for the majority in that case. Footnote 4 on page 8 of the Slip opinion, he says, "We rest our conclusion of structural error upon the difficulty of assessing the effect of the error." At page 10, he says, "Harmless error analysis in such a context would be speculative inquiry into what might have occurred in an alternate universe." Vivid writing there, but there it is. And finally, he writes, "A choice of counsel violation occurs whenever And the emphasis is his. The defendant's choice is wrongfully denied. Now, what sets this kind of situation apart from your garden variety effective assistance of counsel issue is that the identity of counsel has pervasive effects. It's unlike the case of an attorney who, for example, pulls punches with a particular witness due to multiple representation. It's unlike the attorney who falls asleep for one witness's testimony. It's unlike the attorney who fails to investigate or interview a particular witness. Or it's unlike an attorney who commits some other discreet or what Justice Scalia at page 10 calls an identifiable blunder. It is the very pervasiveness and the inability of the system to track back and isolate out the pervasive effects depending on who the attorney is and what that attorney brings to the process, a lifetime of experience. All kinds of lights are going off here, so...
You'll have time.
That is what I think is the short version. This court has had a number of cases that have wrestled with the search for error when it's necessary, when it's infeasible, when matters of public policy dictate that the search for error be abandoned because the integrity of the system is at stake.
Counsel, go back to the declaration of Captain Lee.
I have it in front of me.
Yeah. He said there that he was told that Captain R was going to be wrapping up his duties, there would be no conflict of interest, he'd be prosecuting minor drug offenses, and that he later found out that Captain R worked for Major K the last week of the case, which was in May. How do we know that everything in the affidavit with respect to what Captain R told him wasn't true? That is, at the time in February, that he may have believed he was only doing drug cases. He had no idea that he was working for Kay or that Kay would be his supervisor. We don't know that, do we?
You mean to the extent that those are predictive statements, they may have been true at the time, but the fact that
they may have been true at the time, which then may implicate whether there should have been a subsequent disclosure. But do we have anything from Captain R as to what actually happened from his perspective?
Yes, your question is a fair one, and it may be that there were continuing problems. But I believe that this disclosure, even with the question mark that you fairly raised about it, is certainly late, according to the record that we have, and I believe economical with the truth, and economical with the information. And also incorrect as to whether the circumstances presented a conflict of interest. That's the core of it. This was an attorney providing options and providing legal advice to a client in a criminal case.
Counsel, I understand your answer to my question. Thank you.
On rebuttal, will you address your view of how the Supreme Court's decision in Mickens versus Taylor plays into this? You're familiar with the case?
Yes, I believe that's a multiple representation case.
It was a case where the counsel represented Mickens. I don't remember if it was Mickens or it was Taylor. It was a habeas case. And as it turned out, he had also been representing the victim of the murder and forcible sodomy at the time. That he was representing the person that was accused of the crime and did not disclose that fact to him.
Let me do it right now.
But you understand the parallel, which is he did not disclose that fact, and so to the extent that the argument rests on ability to make an informed decision about counsel, I think that there are some parallels there.
Yes. The difference, however, is that is a pre-Gonzalez-Lopez case, obviously, and the Supreme Court's, added a measure of analysis that wasn't present at the time of Mickens. In addition, this is a situation in which you're not talking about a discrete or identifiable conflict that would go, for example, to how you're going to cross-examine the victim, which is the Mickens problem.
Well, he was this the victim to, was dead, but yes.
Well, that's the overarching distinction, because where you have the prosecutor as your boss, I mean, that is a global problem rather than a a problem that comes to earth only when you're talking about cross-examining a victim. This goes to the entire relationship.
In your view, you would be looking at this matter in a different light because it's the military justice system. Does that play any part in your argument, or is this a pure and simple Sixth Amendment analysis that would be decided exactly the same in any other court in the country?
I do not see this as a special situation, and let me say that I'm aware, and I say that mindful of the concern that Chief Judge Crawford repeatedly expressed about the extent to which departures from Supreme Court precedent could be justified based on the special circumstances of the military. I don't see this as such a case.
I was thinking more of the reporting system and the concerns that led to the divergence in the trial counsel and the prosecutorial reporting systems in the first place, as opposed to departing from Supreme Court precedent.
I see. Thank you. I believe that there are certainly sort of cultural and organizational dimensions to this that are worth bearing in mind as the Court sorts out the issues. The fact is that the Marine Corps' current arrangement dates to 1984, according to something I read on the subject, and the Marine Corps apparently did not do quite the job that the Navy did in creating Naval Legal Service offices originally, but that whatever the arrangements were in terms of segregating trial and defense services, what happened here was at least an oversight and a very severe one in terms of trying to preserve collaborative relationships and avoid any dilution of loyalty. I don't see this as going off on matters that are peculiar to the military. It's important to know about them. That's why you're here. But I don't actually see this as involving a material departure from the kind of mindset that one sees in Gonzalez-Lopez.
Thank you, counsel.
Thank you.
Before counsel for the government begins, given the extra time that was provided to the defense, we'll stick with the 20-minute clock, but if you feel you need more time at the end, please feel free to let us know.
May it please the Court. My name is Lieutenant Derek Butler, and along with Colonel Louis Puglio, I represent the government. There was no conflict of interest in this case, and there was no Sixth Amendment violation. And despite appellant's attempts to categorize the case to the contrary, it is not a case about the issue to have the counsel of one's choice. It is a case about conflict and having the right to have a conflict-free counsel. In fact, as noted by Judge Ryan, in the case of Mickens versus Taylor, there was an undisclosed conflict, and the court treated that as a conflicts case, not as a case about the right to have the counsel of one's choice. Appellants attempted to conflate two lines of Sixth Amendment cases that could be relevant for analyzing this claim. The first is the United States versus Gonzalez-Lopez claim, a line of cases that deals with having the counsel of one's choice.
Can you say that, but why is there no conflict in this case?
Well, there isn't, Your Honor, because it certainly was a situation that had a possible conflict, but it never materialized. Dealing with the test applied in Kula versus Sullivan and Mickens versus Taylor, in looking for the conflict in this case, there's no actual conflict that showed up on the record in the form of an adverse representation or an adverse.
Wait, hang on. Let me make sure this is whether you're making a legal argument or a factual argument. If we stipulate that the defense counsel was also assigned in working with the trial counsel at the same time, are you arguing that's not an actual conflict of interest?
Yes, Your Honor, I am. It is a situation, the government would see that it is a possible conflict of interest that could materialize, but
there's no actual conflict of interest for a defense counsel to be working for the other side at the same time that they're representing someone in a court. That's the government's position?
Yes, Your Honor, because of Article 37 of the UCMJ that forbids his rating senior, Major K, from using Captain R's performance in this trial to give him an adverse fit rep in any way.
Counsel, just for the sake of of clarity, when you say no conflict, you're not talking, I'm assuming, and I could be wrong, that you don't mean that there's no conflict in terms of, from an ethics standpoint, you're talking about no conflict in the Sixth Amendment sense of the term?
Yes, Your Honor. In the Sixth Amendment sense, certainly the ethical question is a different question, albeit somewhat related, but different. But in the facts of this case, in this situation, it is not... A defense counsel should not be, because of Article 37 of the UCMJ in military practice, should not in any way feel constrained in his zealous representation of a defense client. Given this court's precedent, United States versus Hayes and United States versus Hubbard, in dealing from the Sixth Amendment perspective, there is no actual conflict. There certainly, there could be a situation where a defense counsel would feel that performing well against his supervisor would limit him, and certainly ethically he would have to disclose that to his client.
So the decision as to whether or not there's an actual conflict is in the defense attorney's realm to make that decision?
No, Your Honor, from that.
And that's what you just said. At some point, he may decide that there is an actual conflict.
Stepping into the ethical realm and dealing with the ethical question, from the ethical perspective, if he had a duty to disclose, that would be on him. But from the Sixth Amendment perspective, Your Honor, no, the test is examining the record to see if the possible conflict ever materialized into an actual conflict that caused an adverse impact on representation.
And what would trigger an actual conflict?
It would be a situation where a defense counsel chose to provide less than zealous representation or to not highlight...
So in your view, it's perfectly permissible in the government's view for an individual at the same time to spend his mornings defending cases and his afternoons prosecuting cases for a 2 or 3 year period with no problem?
Your Honor, I think that's the point of Article 37 of the UCMJ and the part of military officers that we're talking about, that it involves an assumption that a military officer's defense counsel would place his own personal interest above his ethical duty to provide zealous representation to his client. And even to analogize to a similar situation, Your Honor, it's not that this couldn't show up in the form of an adverse impact, but it's that it has not in this case. And in a similar situation in the Ninth Circuit in Garcia versus Brunel, dealt with a situation where a defense attorney was defending a case against the DA's office, and he had already been hired to begin work at the DA's office at the end of that case. And there, the Ninth Circuit employed the Kuehler versus Sullivan test. It didn't find inherent prejudice. It did not automatically reverse. It looked for an actual conflict that adversely impacted prejudice.
Aren't you mixing up prejudice and conflict as to whether, I mean, what you're saying is that if there was some action that prejudiced the client in this case, then there would be an actual conflict. But can't there be an actual conflict that may or may not have prejudicial consequences?
Well, Your Honor, there can't be, in a conflict in the sense of a Sixth Amendment case, applying the Kuehler versus Sullivan test, it's the government's position that there is no Sixth Amendment violation of the right to conflict-free counsel without both, first, an actual conflict, and second, an adverse impact on the representation.
Well, counsel, I think that the part of the problem is, as I understand your argument, it sounds like you're saying that it would be perfectly fine and acceptable for a military judge advocate to represent, you know, the government in the morning and the defense in the afternoon, and that would be fine, well, and good because, you know, the UCMJ protects them against adverse fitness reports. And I don't think that, and I don't mean to speak for my colleagues, but I don't think that anyone in this room is going to agree with you that that, as a matter of common sense, is a good idea or that anyone would want the legal service offices to be run that way.
Your Honor, no, let me say, I'm not here in a policy role arguing for what should or should not be the policy.
You don't disagree that under the ethical rules of every state in this country that you're not allowed, as a matter of course, to represent both sides.
Yes, Your Honor. And perhaps there is a better setup that could be pursued, but in dealing with this strictly in terms of the legal question, which is separate from the ethical question that I don't believe is before this Court, but in dealing with it in terms of the legal question and the Sixth Amendment precedent, it's incumbent upon this Court in these situations to say this is as it did in United States versus Hayes and United States versus Hubbard, to say this is a situation where we could find adverse impact on the representation and engage in an analysis of the record to see if there was zealous, unhampered representation or if there was
impact. The appellant wants to argue structural error, no need to demonstrate prejudice. You want to get past the actual conflict problem and get to no adverse impact, why shouldn't the burden be on the government to demonstrate no adverse impact? It's the government that created this situation.
Your Honor, that would be contrary to Supreme Court's precedent in Mickens versus Taylor and Hewler versus
Sullivan. And those are cases that deal with the government assigning someone who is a military officer to both sides?
No, Your Honor. They dealt with multiple representation. I believe they
were
assigned.
Where the defense counsel create the problem. But here the government is the one who came to the defense counsel and assigned him to be trial counsel at the same time. And now all of a sudden the defendant has to demonstrate prejudice when the government created the problem.
Yes, Your Honor, but in the same sense, in Mickens versus Taylor and Hewlett versus Sullivan, the court appointed, I believe, the defense attorneys in this case. So it was still a government-created problem because the court was appointed.
So the government can go ahead and apply your system where they have, actually, this would be a great way to cut down on the number of JAGs. So I suspect it's going to be adopted shortly. So you have one attorney representing both sides, and then the defense has to try and prove that that was somehow prejudicial, and the government then says, no, protected by government attorney-client privilege, you lose. It's a great system you've designed.
Well, Your Honor,
why shouldn't the government demonstrate no adverse impact if they create the problem? The Supreme Court was not addressing that scenario.
No, they weren't, Your Honor, but I think the rationale behind that is applicable for the situation. Ineffective assistance, the same claim could be made, Your Honor, and certainly ineffective assistance of counsel claims are lodged against military defense counsel, and that is a government-appointed attorney, but still the burden is on appellant to demonstrate the ineffectiveness of that counsel to establish a Sixth Amendment violation. And I don't think that the nature of it, even though the potential conflict was certainly created by the government here, I don't think the nature of it changed it to where there's a burden on the government to demonstrate that there
was. Well, there's a difference in that defense counsel, the defendant or others can observe the defense counsel while they're being ineffective or not. But what the defendant can't do is observe the defense counsel when he's meeting with the trial counsel behind closed doors about some other case doing trial counsel work. So a lot of what is relevant to deciding whether there's a conflict that is adverse in impact is behind the government's closed door.
Yes.
Unlike a defense situation of IAC.
Yes, Your Honor, but I think the nature of the allegation, I can't think of an analogous situation where the mere making a prima facie claim puts the burden on the government to show that the rest of the claim is not established. I mean, the precedent here says there is no Sixth Amendment violation without establishing an adverse impact on the record.
Are you aware of any case in any jurisdiction where that deals with facts like this, where putting aside your first piece, whether there's actual or not, where the actual conflict at stake was the attorney representing both sides at the same time?
Well, the most analogous situation, Your Honor, is the Ninth Circuit case of Garcia versus Brunel, where the defense counsel had obtained employment with the DA.
Prospective employment.
He had been accepted for employment, yes.
That's the most analogous case.
Yes.
Okay. Can we tell from the record whether this trial counsel / defense counsel was or was not influenced in his basic strategic decisions by his involvement with the government?
Yes, Your Honor, I think we can tell two ways. First is by looking at the record, just some brief examples. On page 224, there's effective cross-examination where he elicits exculpatory information from Sergeant Anderson. On page 213, he impeaches Staff Sergeant Forbes with a prior inconsistent statement. And on page 393, he impeaches Corporal Kellogg and elicits more potentially exculpatory information. And the cross-examinations are similar throughout the record of zealous advocacy. And I think that there's nothing in the record to support the inference that he withheld in any way in this case, Your Honor.
The code is supposed to be a flexible instrument for use in war and peace. And let me just ask you this. Was the transfer of Captain R. motivated by military necessity, or was it basically an administrative convenience? Or do we know?
We don't know based on this record, Your Honor. And I think that gets to the first part of Appellant's argument as to the lack of facts that are known about this.
Well, he was getting out, was he not? We do know that.
We do know that.
He was separated.
He was on his way out, and I'm
so if there was a military necessity, the necessity was going to stop in May.
It was, Your Honor. And which goes to the point, though, that if this court were to disagree with the government and find that this somehow had transformed from a potential conflict into an actual identifiable conflict on the record, that this case, the appropriate remedy then would be to remand to discover all the facts as to exactly when the transfer happened, when the notification happened, what the notification was, things that could be sorted out at a fact-finding hearing.
Speaking of facts, and I'm sorry I don't know this, but do we know if the military judge in this case knew that this trial that this defense counsel had also begun work as a trial counsel?
It could probably be inferred, Your Honor, but nothing in the record supports one way or the other than assuming common practice and knowledge of both shops there. I'd like to take...
Counsel, with respect to Article 37, why does an Article 37 show us that Congress well understood the frailties of humans as counsel and that this was a situation that people shouldn't be in? That is, Article 37 is the ultimate prohibition on taking these actions, but doesn't that reflect an understanding on the part of the Congress, particularly the Congress that had experienced the military justice system of World War II, that this is a situation in which an individual should not be placed in, that is, being raided by an opponent?
Your Honor, I think not. I think Article 37 prohibits what we all know to be wrong, which would be to provide a bad fitness report or an adverse report because of zealous representation, because the defense counsel was so effective that he, in fact, showed up the senior prosecutor and obtained an acquittal. Article 37 forbids that, and that is what should be protected. And
how do we know in this case that Captain R wouldn't come in and say, oh, yeah, I did my job in this case, but I always knew that with Major K, there were certain buttons I shouldn't push, and so I stayed in my lane. How do we know he wouldn't say that?
I think the first is by examining the record. I think the Supreme Court precedent, Your Honor, to directly and simply answer your question, we don't. But I don't think that we need to know the answer to that question in order to see whether there was a Sixth Amendment violation. The test put forth by the Supreme Court and applied by the federal circuits looks to the record and the zealousness and quality of the representation on that record. They do not delve into the questions of what could have been or assuming where things were held back.
If we were in federal district court, wouldn't we have a hearing on this situation right now? That is, if the accused filed a collateral attack in federal district court, wouldn't this be enough under an Article 3 setting to have a fact-finding hearing as to what precisely happened?
I don't believe so, Your Honor. It could be, but I don't believe so because the record would be fully developed, and as I understand the precedent, the test is to examine that record and quality of representation on the record.
That's not my understanding of collateral proceedings in federal district court. That is that there is a standard at which fact-finding hearings are required. I don't know whether this would or not meet that standard, but that is one of the first things that a federal district court will have to decide in a collateral proceeding, whether there are facts that need to be developed.
Your Honor, I may be mistaken as to that. I would distinguish this on the ground, though, that this is a direct appeal, not a collateral proceeding. So I think instantly is in a different situation. In order to get to his fact-finding hearing, he needs to set forth a claim. It's the government's position that the fact-finding hearing would only be relevant to determine if there was a full disclosure here, if in fact this court identified a conflict. Without a conflict, there's no need to examine the disclosure. And I'd like to move back
are you arguing that there was full disclosure?
No, Your Honor, I'm not making that argument. I think that could be assumed on the record, but it's the government's position that if there's a conflict identified on this record, there are not enough facts at hand to know one way or the other as to whether this was or was not a full disclosure.
And then your position is, but this record doesn't reflect that conflict, so it does not matter whether there was full disclosure?
Correct, Your Honor, because as this record reflects, there was no conflict to disclose. No conflict ever materialized.
Well, if you don't agree with the affidavit of Lee, you had the opportunity to file a counter affidavit.
Your Honor, it was the government's position that there was no conflict, so the nature of the disclosure was irrelevant and not necessary to decide this case, and in fact, it was most beneficial to have precedent addressing the legal question at hand, rather than being able to say that, in fact, there was a full disclosure and sort of, for lack of a better term, punt on the main issue before us. That we'd like to have the issue addressed to say that there was no conflict in this case, because I think the precedent clearly states that, and it would be good to have precedent addressing that issue in the military. And secondly, many defense counsels, the government has found through experience, are reluctant to provide affidavits without a court order because of individual state bar rules that they are under. So it's the combination of the two is the reason that has not been rebutted. But
so I understand your position, what you would like this court to do to straighten out this field is to issue an opinion that says that a individual assigned to a prosecutor's office and prosecuting part-time and evaluated by the senior prosecutor may also defend individuals without running into any Sixth Amendment problems, and particularly in the Navy, since there are no ethical provisions that address that, they shouldn't come into play.
Essentially, Your Honor, but I think it would be worded a little more harshly towards the government to say that this court could follow its precedent in Hayes and Hubbard and say we will closely analyze these situations. They are greatly disfavored, but given the understanding...
Well, if they're greatly disfavored, why do you want to do it? I mean, isn't there some common sense that we should ascribe to the government here?
Your Honor, if I were standing in a role providing advice to the Judge Advocate General of the Navy as to how to set up his shop, I might provide different advice, but I think they're separate questions. There certainly is a question that inheres in this situation that all of us attorneys find this situation perfectly less than desirable. But I think it's necessary to be careful to separate from that and ask the question of, okay, perhaps this is or is not the best policy, but as far as this court's concerned, did it lead to a Sixth Amendment violation?
And just give me one more question here,
yes,
and I believe this Chief Judge will give you additional time if necessary, but is there any role at all for ethical considerations in determining whether or not an actual conflict occurs during a Sixth Amendment analysis?
Your Honor, I would say not, and I point this court to the language from the Supreme Court's decision in Nix versus Whiteside, where it said, when examining Sixth Amendment claims, the court must be careful not to narrow the wide range of acceptable conduct permissible under the Sixth Amendment to make it so restrictive as to constitutionalize particular standards of ethical conduct.
But that says not to narrow it. It doesn't say not to take into consideration.
Yes, Your Honor. They are relevant for consideration, but they are not the be-all and end-all of the question.
Thank you.
Counsel?
Following up on Judge Erdman's question, does that mean that you would like us to address this case taking the appellant's affidavit as the facts?
If, Your Honor, to analyze whether there was a conflict, to accept them as true for the purposes of determining whether there was a conflict that... No, let me clarify. No, Your Honor.
You just said you didn't want to debate. You wanted an opinion.
I want an opinion, but if the opinion is adverse to the government, I think you are
right. You like to return it. Yeah.
I suspect that your opposing counsel feels the same way.
Yeah.
Yes, exactly. Well, I think, truthfully, there are two questions. One is, was there a conflict? And then the second question is, was that conflict waived? And I think if the court wants to answer the question as to whether there was a full disclosure and a waiver of that conflict, it can't on this record.
But you're prepared to have this court address the question, was there a conflict?
Yes, Your Honor.
Based on the affidavit before us, full stop.
Because I think that the affidavit is not necessary to address the conflict question. There is no fact-finding or further facts necessary to address that.
Just so we're clear, your position is decided on that affidavit, but if the question is whether there was full disclosure, it's the government's view that a Dubay hearing is necessary.
Yes, Your Honor.
So to draw the parallel to civilian life, if an individual is being prosecuted in federal district court, and his defense counsel during the midst of that prosecution is hired by the U.S. Attorney's Office as a special contract attorney, and that his employment rating and his employment is subject to the approval and rating of the person who is acting as the prosecutor in the underlying case in federal district court. There's no conflict of interest.
There is a possible conflict of interest, Your Honor, and I think the record would have to be closely analyzed to see if it ever materialized and impacted the representation. But the
and what case stands for the proposition that that sort of arrangement is permissible in civilian life?
Well, Your Honor, I think it's very closely, but not directly analogous, is the Garcia versus Bunnell case out of the Ninth Circuit, which is found at 33 F3rd 1193, Your Honor, where he had obtained employment with the DA's office and defended a case against that district attorney after obtaining the employment, Your Honor, where the test there was not, I'd like to clarify very briefly, the test here is not prejudice in the sense of Strickland, that there of a reasonable probability of a different result, but it's a test of adverse impact. And if that adverse impact is found, the Supreme Court precedent says that there's an inherent prejudice if that adverse impact is found.
That's the second prong of Strickland, then.
Yes, Your Honor.
Under the first prong, is it permissible?
Yes, Your Honor, but in the conflicts cases, the first prong is whether there was an actual conflict. And an appellant is trying to also categorize this case in the category that this court identified in United States versus Keene, where it didn't even go into the second prong of the Kuehler versus Sullivan analysis, found that there was an actual conflict and didn't look for adverse impact on the record. But those are very unique, special line of cases that involve a criminal conduct by the attorney that is similar to that which the client is accused of, or an ethical violation and criminal offense such as in Keene, or an unlicensed attorney. In those cases, courts have found an actual conflict and not looked for adverse impact. But the case today is more similar to the multiple representation cases and to the cases before this court in United States versus Babbitt, dealing with sexual relationship with the client, in United States versus, I believe it was McLean, this court addressed the issue of a conflict of interest where the defendant wanted to pursue one strategy and the attorney wanted to pursue another. In both of those cases, the court applied Kuehler versus Sullivan, looked for an actual conflict and adverse impact on the representation. And finally, as my last point, under United States versus Hayes, the court addressed the situation that we have here, which is most relevant, is that there was a lead civilian attorney in this case. And if there had been any impact on the representation, it would have been incumbent upon this lead civilian attorney to limit Captain R's involvement in the case or seek to have him removed from the case. But the record shows no effort whatsoever in that regard. The civilian attorney allowed Captain R to do representation all through the trial.
And does the record reflect that the civilian attorney knew all that we know today?
It doesn't reflect one way or the other, Your Honor. A common assumption, given the affidavit by appellant, is that civilian counsel would have been aware of the situation as well, but the record does not explicitly state that.
At least to the extent reflected in the affidavit.
Yes, Your Honor. And under Hayes, this court found that there could be no prejudice on the representation because it was a civilian counsel who had no ethical limits whatsoever, not even a possible conflict. Finally, in conclusion, I think the situation here presented a possible conflict that could materialize and should be closely analyzed to see whether it materialized into a actual conflict when these cases arise. But in this case, it never materialized into an actual conflict. And an examination of the record shows a zealous, ethical, quality representation and a fair trial under the Sixth Amendment, which is where the right to conflict-free counsel derives from. And the Supreme Court clarified in United States versus Gonzalez-Lopez that the right...
Can I be clear in your terminology? If I own $1 million in Microsoft stock, I wish, and I'm doing a case as a judge where their financials... You know, it affects the financial impact of that. Is that an actual conflict, or only if I decide the case based on my financial interests?
The situation, I believe, Your Honor, is unique with judges, and I'm not familiar with judicial ethics canons and recusal rules for.
I'm trying to find a simple hypothetical. I can't tell with the government's argument whether your view is that there's no such thing, you don't have an actual conflict until you actually are influenced by the conflict, or whether the actual conflict exists at the time that it exists, subject to prejudice analysis, which has to do with impact.
It is, Your Honor, that the situation, such as the one at hand, that could, under certain circumstances, with a particular superior rating of seniors on the trial side and particular defense counsel, it could result in a conflict, but it does not every time. It's similar to the situation with representation of multiple co-defendants.
And again, when you're talking about conflict in response to Judge Baker's question, it might be helpful if you made clear that you're talking about conflict for purposes of the Sixth Amendment as opposed to conflict for purposes of ethical rules that govern attorneys, judges, et cetera, because they're two different things, and you're not making that clear.
Yes, Your Honor. There's the answer I'm looking for.
Well,
yes.
To follow up on that, would there be any circumstance in which it would have been proper for the defense counsel in this case, putting aside the Sixth Amendment, to not disclose? That is, if the facts are as stated in the affidavit, and let's say the conflict, let's say that the awareness on defense counsel did not arise until the Article 32. Is there any circumstance in which, at that point, the defense counsel would be justified in keeping silent with respect to his client as to the fact that he was now working for the opposing counsel in the client's case?
Well, in light of Judge Ryan's question, Your Honor, I do want to clarify that I think that presents an ethical situation, and it could be a violation of a particular ethical canon, but it's not the question I'm here to answer today. The question is...
That's the question that was being asked right then, though.
Yeah, so I think you should probably answer the Chief Judge question.
Yes, Your Honor. It's my understanding, per the applicable JAG Corps ethics rules, as particularly Model Rule 1.7, that situation would not materially limit the representation provided by Captain R to his client, so he would not have a duty to disclose. But in abundance of caution, he certainly should, and it would be the best policy had he done so.
I understand your position. Thank you.
Yes, Your Honor, but because the ABA opinion cited work here is an informal opinion and not binding upon the military, not adopted by the military committee that sets the ethics rules.
Well, what about attorneys being subject to the ethics rules of their particular state? Has that changed, or is that still the case?
In situations where there are, yes, Your Honor, they are still. In situations where there are conflicts between the JAG Corps instruction and their state ethics rules, generally the JAG Corps prevails. But, yes, they are still subject to their state bar. Now, the record doesn't tell us what bar Captain R was a member of and what his ethics rules were. So, yes, there's a possibility that this was a violation of the state ethics rules. But it's the government's position that violating state ethics rules, while it's a factor in the analysis, does not establish a Sixth Amendment conflict. It may establish an ethical conflict. Because, as the Supreme Court laid out in United States versus Gonzalez-Lopez, the right to a conflict-free counsel under the Sixth Amendment comes from the right to ensure a fair trial. It's separate from the Gonzalez-Lopez right to counsel of choice, which is at the root meaning of the Sixth Amendment. Therefore, it's a structural error. The right to a conflict-free counsel is not a structural error. It comes from the Sixth Amendment's purpose to ensure a fair trial, and I believe that's why the Supreme Court has adopted the test that it has in Keeler versus Sullivan. It's the test.
But what about Gonzalez-Lopez, where the court made a point of saying the goal is not a fair trial, the goal is the means by which you test for a fair trial, which is conflict-free counsel?
Yes, Your Honor, it's conflict-free counsel, but the only test the Supreme Court has applied and the federal circuits have applied is the test of an actual conflict that resulted in adverse impact on the representation, because its purpose is ensuring a fair trial.
Other than in Gonzalez-Lopez, you're saying?
I'm saying this case is distinguishable from Gonzalez-Lopez, Your Honor. The fact of having all the information available about your counsel is a conflicts question, not a question about having the counsel of one's choice. He had the counsel of his choice. He didn't know all the information that he wanted to, according to the affidavit, about this counsel, but that doesn't turn it into a right to the counsel of one's choice.
And to return to the disclosure question, in recognizing that the government is arguing that the ethics rules are not pertinent to the Sixth Amendment, is your position that there was no duty to disclose in this case is that based upon an official position of the Judge Advocate General with respect to his ethics responsibilities? Is it the official position of the United States, or is it your analysis based on the duty of counsel to respond to questions from the bench?
It is my analysis, Your Honor. I'm not here speaking for Rule 13 is the Judge Advocate General's branch that implements these rules and interprets them, and I'm not here officially interpreting them on behalf of Rule 13.
Thank you.
If there are no further questions, that concludes my argument on behalf of the United States, and I respectfully request this Court to affirm the lower court's opinion and apply the Keller v. Sullivan test.
Thank you, counsel. Does the defense have rebuttal?
Extremely briefly, there are two points I'd like to make. First, with respect to the duty of disclosure, we believe that that duty is a continuing duty. And as circumstances change and evolve, counsel have a continuing duty to promptly inform the client so that client may continually, as appropriate, be evaluating whether there are some things that he or she should be doing in respect of election of counsel. The second point I'd like to make is as a result of a colloquy that counsel had with one of the members of the court. I said before that I thought that there was that this case didn't really turn on peculiarly military aspects of the matter, and it is my belief that doctrinally that is correct. However, as was pointed out in a colloquy, there are unusual aspects to the military. Obviously, it's an officially enforced hierarchical environment, which you know, on a certain level lacks parallels in the civilian community. And it's a system, and I'm not actually aware of how prosecutors are evaluated in the civilian sector, but either federal or state, but it is a system in which performance is evaluated with respect to every officer and every enlisted member. And to the extent that that is a unique attribute of the military workplace, that is a pertinent consideration. Nonetheless, our position continues to be that doctrinally applying Gonzales-Lopez, which adds some analytical elements that were not present, let us say, in this Court's earlier effort to grapple with these issues, we're clearly in the structural error part of the forest. So if the Court has no further questions.
Do we need to overrule Hubbard for you to win?
No.
How so?
I think the law has, for one thing, let's go back now. Not to be hasty, I do think that Hubbard was wrongly decided.
Even in what the circumstances that obtained in 1971.
Well, yes, I think it was.
That's your prerogative.
Well, that's I don't have a vote, but I do think that was an unfortunate decision that the Court would do well to distance itself from, let us say. Today, much more is, there's been a lot of water over the dam with respect to the responsibilities of counsel. That was a pre-ABA opinion decision. I think our society and our profession have evolved in important ways. In 1971, probably most law schools didn't even teach professional responsibility. I think today it's required on every state bar. I think the profession as a whole, including the military, is
what's
much
the short
more.
Answer: yes or no? Overrule Hubbard?
Yes.
Okay.
It should be overruled.
Counsel, the government takes a position, I think generally, that if there was a conflict here, it was an ethical conflict, and there was not a Sixth Amendment conflict. You build much of your argument based on ethical considerations. How do you tie in the ethical violations and arguments that you make to a Sixth Amendment violation?
I think the ethical considerations help inform thinking about the Constitution. I'm actually not at all sure I can divorce the ethical considerations from what the Constitution demands. In any event, I think the ethical deficiencies of what happened here, the hypothetical, it's really an unimaginable hypothetical, except it happens to have happened here, of a prosecutor working as a trial counsel, a prosecutor working as a defense counsel at the same time, albeit in different proceedings, bumps into both the ethics wall as well as the constitutional wall. I don't think those are in tension.
The number of possibilities in this case would be to find that it's inherently prejudicial overall, Hubbard. Second would be to say case by case determination of prejudice with the possibility of a debate hearing, and then determine on the record that it's not prejudicial. Am I correct in assuming that only the first option requires overruling Hubbard?
What was the second?
The second option would be case-by-case analysis to determine prejudice.
I beg your pardon.
Case-by-case analysis to determine prejudice. My recollection is that Hubbard expressly recognized the possibility that in any particular case, that Hubbard does not stand for the proposition that the relationship set forth in that case is inherently non-prejudicial.
Well, I believe that the circumstances here can never be defended. They could never satisfy.
That's not my question. My question is, do we have to overrule Hubbard in order to order a debate proceeding or further factual inquiry in this case?
No, you certainly.
That answers my question. Thank you.
The answer to that question is no.
I have another question, if you don't mind. Can we agree with you that the circumstances here, you know, are indefensible, that it should not have happened, and nonetheless, if we apply Mickens and Collier in that line of cases, look at the record of the trial and say, but there's no prejudice here, that nothing in the record discloses or demonstrates or suggests that this particular counsel in any way pulled his punches or didn't zealously represent his client?
If the answer is no, and the reason is we had an unmistakable signal from a majority of the sitting justices in the Gonzalez-Lopez case.
Okay. Well, if we disagree with you about how broadly that case sweeps or what precisely it turns upon, is that a different answer to my question?
No, I don't think it is. On any number of levels, just to take the one which has to do with the public confidence in the administration of justice. There's an irreducible minimum that I think the court has to be concerned about, permitting what on a certain level is a scandalous arrangement to be tolerated. Because I know how an analysis will come out. You cannot demonstrate. It is in the nature, for the reasons the majority in Gonzalez-Lopez pointed out, you cannot extirpate, infect here. It's impossible to do. It's like trying to, the analogies would get away from me and you'd all be angry, so I won't do that. But you really can't do it. And that's what, and I believe, in fact, that there's great wisdom in Justice Scalia's opinion in Gonzalez-Lopez, because there's a recognition that the task involved in trying to track the amorphous, elusive effects, particularly in a choice of counsel case, is infeasible.
Do you recall, because I do not, whether or not...
And therefore, it would be an illusory ruling, and I don't think the court should engage in an illusory ruling.
Do you recall if Justice Scalia, who also wrote Mickens versus Taylor, mentioned Mickens versus Taylor in Garcia-Lopez?
Well, I don't.
I can probably check that.
Oh, if there are no further questions, I thank the court for its attention.
Thank you, counsel. We thank counsel for both parties for your presentation today. The case is now submitted, and the court will stand in recess until 9 a.m. tomorrow morning.
The court stands in recess until 9 a.m. tomorrow.